Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Kavanaugh effect reflected in Trump's recent rhetoric that expands on male victimhood, which he used successfully in the 2016 campaign to convince the white working class they are being marginalized by minorities who are taking away their jobs and feminists who are taking away their manhood. Now, with Senator McConnell dismissing female protesters as a mob, Republicans are embracing the victimhood of a privileged white male to expand their base of beleaguered and oppressed men to make the case that not only has Kavanaugh been wronged, but his unfair treatment by the Democrats and the media shows that any man can be victimized in the era of the Me Too movement. Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas, Austin, whose work has focused on the radical feminist critique of sexuality and men's violence, as well as questions of race through a critique of white privilege and institutionalized racism, joins us. We'll discuss President Trump's remarks following his victory celebration after seating Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, which suggests the contentious confirmation has now become a trial over masculinity and embattled manhood. In response to a reporter's question about what would he say to young men in America, Trump replied, quote, "Well, I'd say that it's a scary time for young men in America when you could be guilty of something you may not be guilty of." Then we'll examine the elections today underway in Brazil, in which the leading Trump-like presidential candidate, Jair Bolsonaro, is even more open and extreme in expressing his authoritarian tendencies, saying an opposition female candidate is not worth raping and that he would prefer a dead son to a gay son. Joining us for an update on whether Bolsonaro will get the 50% of the vote to avoid a runoff is Maria Luisa Mendoza, the director of Brazil's Network for Social Justice and Human Rights, who is also a professor in the International Relations Department at the University of Rio de Janeiro. We'll assess the fate of Brazil's fragile democracy and whether the country will return to right-wing dictatorship. Then finally, with a month to go before the critical midterm elections, we will analyze the state of voting in the country following the record low turnout in the last 2014 midterms, in which only 140 million Americans voted, the lowest turnout since 1942, followed by just over 25% of American adults voting Donald Trump into the presidency in 2016. Alan Lichtman, a political historian at American University who has studied both the American right and the presidency, joins us to discuss his new book just out, The Embattled Vote in America, From the Founding to the Present. And joining us now, Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He is the author of Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And his latest book is The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, it would seem to me that the patriarchy, rather than ending, has gotten a whole new lease on life, with particularly in terms of the future of the judiciary in this country, which will shape our lives profoundly, where you have a patriarchal new judge making a 5-4 majority, perhaps for decades to come, joining another group of patriarchal white men, all of whom have been selected by the Federalist Society, and all of whom are extremely conservative. I don't know. Well, I hope you're right to suggest that there's an end of patriarchy, but at this point, it seems to be getting a revival.
Absolutely. The title of that book, The End of the Patriarchy, I always say was aspirational, not descriptive. That is to say, I'm not suggesting we're there. It's something to remind ourselves to go after. And part of the reason for the title of the book, and I think the important way you phrase this, is even within feminism, you often these days don't hear so much about patriarchy, that is, a system of institutionalized male dominance. And we have to remember it is a social system. Historically, the roots of patriarchy are really in men's claim to control women's reproductive power and women's sexuality. And as you pointed out, we're still fighting both of those battles. Of course, a lot of people's fear about a 5-4 right-wing majority on the court means the end of the rather fragile protection for reproductive rights, especially the right to an abortion. In other words, the assertion again of control over women's sexual or women's reproductive power. And then, of course, the battle to really give women control of their own sexuality we've been fighting for a long time, and not only aren't making so much progress on, but you could say in some ways we've lost ground on. True, there have been advances in, for instance, the way rape laws are written, but in practice it hasn't meant as much. The exploitation of women's sexuality, especially in what I call the sexual exploitation industries, pornography, prostitution, that sort of thing has gone on. And now we're seeing that even the core question of women's right to a kind of bodily integrity against male sexual violence is no longer as secure as we want. Your point that now Trump is using this to kind of turn the tables and suggest it is men who are at risk is really, one could say it's bizarre, but in a sense it's not. It's just Trump doing what Trump does well, which is invert reality when necessary to shore up his base.
So how do you feel about the fact that it was a woman who got Kavanaugh over the top, Senator Collins? She pretended to be – she's always pretended to be a moderate and also sympathetic to women's rights and in favor of a woman's right to choose. But she effectively – and I'm sure it was in collusion with Mitch McConnell – delivered the closing argument to seal the deal. So what is she, some kind of a traitor?
Well, you know, as a man, I make a point of not telling any women what they should believe or how they should act. But we should remember that a feminist critique, especially a radical feminist critique of patriarchy, never suggested that all women are good and all men are bad. If we go back to the earlier battles around this, let's say the Equal Rights Amendment, for instance, in the 1970s. Remember, it was Phyllis Schlafly, a woman who had used her organizing abilities, and they were considerable, to try and block a feminist movement. You know, some number of women associate their ideas and their future with patriarchy. But that's true of any group. You know, no group is 100% in line with a particular ideology or perspective. But it was, I think, for all of us a little sad to see that particular performance by Susan Collins. But we should also remember, as you did, it was Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump who drove that train. It was men. And not only men, your introduction was important. We're not just talking about an analysis of the sex gender system in patriarchy. We're talking about analysis of race and white supremacy. We're talking about an analysis of economic inequality and capitalism. I think a lot of people, when Brent Kavanaugh made his what seemed almost like a self-parody of a performance in front of the Senate committee, a performance that was so easy to parody that when Matt Damon did it on Saturday Night Live, it didn't even seem like that much of a stretch. That was not just Brent Kavanaugh. That was a very privileged white male who's part of the economic elite in a capitalist society. It was white supremacy, patriarchy, and capitalism on display. It was the way those things work together. And when people in that position are challenged, I think you often see they don't react well. There's a sense of entitlement. You could call it a right to rule that people like Brett Kavanaugh are raised with. Now, obviously not all men who might embrace Kavanaugh are other rich white men. But again, there's a kind of aspirational quality to masculinity than for people who aren't rich. You can see working class men, non-white men, who also want to be in that same position and might rally around Kavanaugh. That aggrieved entitlement is another phrase one hears, a sense that I have a right to this, and these challenges that might come from women or non-white people or from the labor unions, these challenges to my right to that position produce a kind of almost hysterical anxiety. And that's a good word for the way Kavanaugh reacted. You know, women are used to be calling used to be called hysterical if they are angry over injustice. But it really was Kavanaugh who was hysterical over this threat to his entitlement.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And his latest book is The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. But on the Democratic side, the two men who blew it were Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader, and Michael Avenatti, the ambulance-chasing lawyer. They really were gifts to the Republicans. I mean, I really do rue the day that Harry Reid left the Senate. And, of course, in the vote, the other candidate who could have been the Minority Leader, Dick Durbin, who's so much better than Schumer. So.
I can't speak to political strategy in Washington. I don't pretend to know how to play that game. But I think you're right that Chuck Schumer seems just perfect for leading a Democratic Party that has no courage and no strategy. The failure seems pretty complete. Avenatti's another interesting character, though, and one I think worth some reflection. You know, a lot of people are holding him out as kind of a champion for the challenge to Trump, but Michael Avenatti is in some ways just the flip side of the Donald Trump coin. He's arrogant, he's you know, kind of a macho posturing bully type. So to watch Avenatti and Trump square off gives me a kind of sick feeling in the pit of my stomach. I'm certainly not on the Trump team, both in terms of, you know, party, in terms of voting, in terms of policy, in terms of anything. But I certainly don't also want to be on Avenatti's team. I don't think that's a way to build a progressive politics. It's both are very good at using media. Both are very good at playing the culture, in a sense. But both come out of that same sense of power as something one grabs, asserts, controls. Certainly not the idea of power as something one builds through engagement and collaboration. So Avenatti's contribution, and I use that in quotes, to the Kavanaugh hearings, of course, has been analyzed. Even people on the Democratic side wish he'd never shown up because the way he played the media and played the client he represented didn't add to the challenge. It detracted from the challenge to Kavanaugh. So that a very serious claim about Kavanaugh's behavior, and not only going back to when he was a teenager, but a critique of his behavior up until today, was easily undercut by people who saw Avenatti as, you know, throwing in a wild claim that was more difficult to substantiate.
Well, he didn't substantiate it.
Yeah.
So, but so we know, Robert, that the majority of men in this country vote Republican, and the majority of women in this country vote Democrat. How much do you think the needle is being moved in any direction here?
Well, you know, this has been the subject of a lot of commentary and analysis the last few days, and I don't pretend to have any particular insight into it. I think on the question of race, the tea leaves are a lot easier to read. Of course, the vast majority of non-white people in this country, especially black and brown, vote Democratic, and that's not going to change at all. The gender question is harder to understand. Will this produce a kind of outpouring of support for the Democrats because people are angry at how badly Blasey Ford and, by extension, women were treated in this? Or will it rally the Republican base? You know, polling seems to say both things are happening. I don't know. But it seems to me the Democratic Party, if it's going to be a useful vehicle for progressive change, in addition to all the other organizations and activities that try to do this, has got to provide a coherent project with coherent leadership. And as you pointed out, people like Chuck Schumer aren't exactly offering that. The wave of progressive successes, by no means, you know, an overwhelming trend that's going to change the Democrats overnight, but they do give some hope that younger people, people with more progressive values, disproportionately more women and people of color than the Democratic Party has typically put up, that that can be a source. But, you know, as many point out, sometimes it's not all that useful to try and predict. These are things we try to do something about and affect. I certainly don't have any predictions.
So how do women, and I mentioned that, you know, Mitch McConnell is sort of marginalizing all those protesters as a mob. And of course, the day after Trump's inauguration, there was a spontaneous manifestation of millions of women across the country and around the world showing up to protest. But in terms of a sustained protest and a strategy, how do you attack misogyny? I mean, you've got the poster boy for misogyny as the president of the United States. He's made it clear what he thinks about women in that Access Hollywood tape. It's, you know, and that didn't sink him for some reason or other. And there's still women who voted for him. So I don't know what the answer is here in terms of, I mean, do women have to resort to Lisa Strider and basically, you know, refuse to have sex with men until they get their act together?
Well, here I think we can observe a couple of things. One is, as many people point out, that if there's a change in electoral politics, it's not going to be just through a critique of patriarchy or just through a critique of white supremacy, just through a critique of capitalism. There has to be a coherent, holistic, unified base for an attempt to grab power through elections. And again, I don't consider myself much of a strategist in those arenas. It's hard work, and we can identify the goal without always being sure of the strategy to go forward. But, you know, I think back to the feminist movement, what's often called the second wave of feminism that came out of the 1960s, all that social ferment of the 60s produced many movements, including feminism. Well, first of all, we should recognize that there have been vast improvements in society because of that. As I often reminded younger students when I was teaching at the University of Texas, that rape crisis centers, domestic violence shelters didn't exist when I was a kid. The concept of date rape, the idea that a woman could be raped by an acquaintance, didn't exist when I was a kid. That all of these are the work of a feminist movement, and that I think the radical nature of the movement that produced those needs to be recaptured. Now, there's a lot of splits in the feminist movement as well, just like in any movement. I work on one of the issues that has been probably the most central split. I come out of a radical feminist critique of the way men routinely buy and sell women's bodies in pornography and prostitution. Not a critique of the women in those industries, but a critique of the industries and the way men exploit women. Well, I think the radical feminist critique is got a lot to offer, and I think reviving a lot of that is important. I think, as has been pointed out many times, in the defense of women's reproductive rights, which is often just a code word, let's face it, for abortion rights, that it's wealthy women who have still the most access to abortion, that poor and working class women often are cut off. And how do we restore not only the full right to abortion, but a meaningful right that is one that people can access? All of these things are part of building a movement. So, you know, we talk about the Me Too movement, and like everybody, I've been impressed by the efforts under that banner. But it's not a movement in the traditional sense. You need a feminist movement that looks across the board at all these issues and isn't afraid to get radical. And I think we see that on the question of challenging white supremacy, the question of challenging capitalism as well. Mere liberal attempts to modify an existing system increasingly don't do the job. And so how do we get back that spirit? But, of course, we're trying to get back that radical spirit at a time when there's a rising right-wing reactionary, some might even say neo-fascist force. So, again, I don't want to pretend there's some obvious solution I'm going to take off the shelf in some nice three-ring notebook and present to people. But I think we do need to think about these things. How does power operate? How do, in this case, men routinely control women? Why do women sometimes find themselves with very few choices and embrace that kind of patriarchal world? You know, here I would go back to some classic work. Andrea Dworkin, a feminist writer now more than a decade gone, interesting book called Right-Wing Women, where she asks that question. Why do women sometimes embrace right-wing politics? And she said it's not because those women are stupid, uninformed, or don't understand their own interests. They've made a choice that their own interests can be furthered that way, and Andrea's argument was, we can understand that, but it's a bad choice, and we need to make arguments that there are better choices for women.
Well, speaking of right-wing women, Kellyanne Conway of the White House recently said that she, too, was sexually assaulted. And a lot of women have come forth, and I don't know what the percentage is, but it's an enormous number of women have experienced some form of sexual assault, if not sexual molestation. And, you know, so how do you turn that movement of victimhood, because the word victim is always used, into victory?
Well, that's a good question. You know, Andrea Dworkin, a real touchstone for me in my education, when noting the shift from victim to survivor, where we talk less about sexual violence victims, more about sexual violence survivors, Andrea, of course, understood the reason, but she said, you know, victim is an important word. It describes a relationship to power. When you are the victim of a crime, you have been a victim, and it doesn't mean you're a victim in your essential nature. It doesn't mean you were born to be a victim. It means that that's the nature of the system in which you live, and it's important to challenge that. You know, Andrea argued that right-wing women know that they're at risk for violence, know that men's violence against women and children is a serious problem, and they make the bet that if they ally themselves with male power, they'll be protected. And, of course, what we know about the reality of domestic violence and sexual violence is you are not, if you're a woman, safe when you're with your men, that is, family, for instance, husbands, fathers, and that. That's, in fact, often when you're at greatest risk. So Andrea's argument was not, I don't understand what might motivate women to try and, in a sense, cut a deal with patriarchy. She said, it's a bad deal. It doesn't protect you in the way that you think it will. And to challenge that, of course, there needs to be a vibrant feminist movement. And, of course, the backlash, and that's another important word to bring back, the 1991 book by Susan Faludi, that when women do make gains, we pointed out that, you know, rape crisis centers, domestic violence shelters were gains that women made in the 1970s and 80s. Well, there was a pushback to that, and Faludi pointed that out quite clearly, that when those feminist gains are made, there's a reaction. That's, for those who are too young to remember, that's the era when people like Rush Limbaugh started coining the term feminazi to, again, suggest that somehow women asserting their rights were an attack on men. You know, we need to remember that this playbook that Trump and Kavanaugh worked from is not new. It feels a lot like just a recycling of that old late 80s, early 90s attack on feminism that Faludi describes.
Well, Robert Jensen, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I appreciate you joining us, and I thank you.
All right. Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen. He's a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and a board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center in Austin. He's the author of Plain Radical, Living, Loving, and Learning to Leave the Planet Gracefully, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. And his latest book is The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the elections underway in Brazil.